So I'm really glad that Michael and Dr. Shrieky went before me because their introductory slides really set up my introduction, and I'll be able to skip a lot, actually, and that's really nice. Before I go a whole lot further, I do want to point out that Dr. Shrieky is the co-PI of this project, and Yuka Asada, who is our timekeeper in the front row and a doctoral candidate at UIC, did a lot of the heavy lifting on collecting this data. So I want to acknowledge them and all the other staff that made this study possible. And there were a number of content experts that served on an advisory board that I'd like to recognize, and then, of course, our funders. This project was part of the CDC and NNPHI's second annual policy competition. So if anybody from CDC or NNPHI is in the room, our thanks to you. That being said, I have no financial disclosures to give. I'm curious if the folks that did the competitive foods research presentations yesterday morning are in the room. Michael, yeah, all right. That's the reason why I ask is yesterday Matthew and Megan called for the need to kind of tell stories about what's happening with competitive foods and districts that are successfully transitioning to stronger nutrition standards. As the first two presentations that we just saw kind of point out, the body of evidence is really growing very rapidly when it comes to competitive foods. But school districts are still a little bit hesitant about moving forward. They want to know how other school districts are making a transition successfully in a way that is financially tenable. And that is what this project is all about. It is about telling stories, success stories, of schools that have transitioned to much stronger nutrition standards without breaking the bank. I'm skipping over this because Michael did an amazing job. This is very relevant to what Dr. Shrieky just talked about. Our starting point for this project, our sampling strategy, really revolved around data that she already had through her Bridging the Gap project. She mentioned that they collect policies all across the nation, usually about 600 or so a year, and analyze those policies in terms of how strong or how weak nutrition standards are with regard to competitive foods. We use Dr. Shrieky's database to identify, starting with 622 districts across the nation, and I might want to point out that that was a nationally representative sample of 622 districts across the country, and screen them for districts that had very strong nutrition standards. Once we identified districts that had strong nutrition standards, we then did a subsequent screening through follow-up phone calls to those districts and found out if they actually had implemented these strong policies or these strong standards. And if the implementation of those standards has been done in a way that was perceived to be financially tenable. So of the 622 districts that we started with, there were only 27 districts that were identified as having strong standards. And of those 27, once we did a little bit more screening, we found that only 14 of those 27 districts qualified for inclusion, meaning that they had actually implemented the standards and that it was perceived to have been done in a way that was financially tenable. I want you to think about that for just a minute. 14 districts out of 622 in a nationally representative sample, that is 2.25% of schools. Finding these districts was literally like looking for a needle in a haystack, and I think it underscores why these success stories, these case studies, are so needed so that people can find the districts that have done this and go ask questions, get in contact with them, so that they can share these stories with policymakers, school boards, other, you know, food service directors and officials within districts and say, this can be done. So that is our goal, is to add to the body of evidence these stories that can be a very practical tool for advocacy and making change in the school systems. Yeah. Oh, yes, I'm so sorry. We only looked at middle and high school. This does not have any elementary schools in this study. So from the 14 districts that qualified, we selected 9 school districts that was based on geography, other issues like participation in the free and reduced meal program, socioeconomic issues. Of those 9, 8 chose to participate. San Francisco Unified School District was one of the 9, and they chose not to participate. And if anybody from San Francisco is here, I'd like to talk to you about that. Maybe it's not too late to join the study.
I think I can help you with that.
Sorry, I'm not supposed to put them in the spotlight like that, but it's an important study, and it's a great opportunity to highlight their success because San Francisco is one of the success stories. But I don't get to share their story here today. I'm going to be in so much trouble. So the exclusion criteria for this screening process, essentially if a school allowed the sale of any candy, any energy drink, soda, or other SSBs, it was out. If the schools had not banned at least five or more of the non-healthy items that were listed in our district-level screener, they were out. And so that's, again, how we got to the 14. But of the 14 that we screened or that were eligible for inclusion, they reported high levels of implementation. And again, done in a way that was perceived to be financially tenable. So here you see middle and high schools that participated across the country. Once we found the 9 districts that we wanted to interview, we, with the help and guidance of our advisory team, developed semi-structured interviews that were then used to call up superintendents, principals, food service directors, and others within the school and ask questions about how they implemented these new nutrition standards. The surveys focus on profit and implementation strategies. There are specific questions about barriers and strategies that were used to overcome those barriers. We did ask about exclusive contracts and future plans. All of the interviews that were conducted were recorded and transcribed. Again, Yuka, sitting in the front row, did a huge number of those phone calls. And then they were coded using a coding scheme. And we checked for inter-rater reliability among 2 different coders, and the inter-rater reliability exceeded the 80% level, which is considered very academically rigorous. So I want to start off by saying that for every different district and school that was in this study, there was a different story to be told. It's really difficult to share outcomes of this project that are considered overarching themes because there were so many different stories to tell. And I want to encourage you all to, when this data is published, which I'm hoping can be sometime in the next month, that you'll read each individual story. And you might be able to find a school district that looks kind of like yours, maybe whether it's in terms of geography or socioeconomic status, and see if their story might relate to you. Or maybe check out a story of a school district that's not like you and see if maybe their examples might still be relevant in your district. But there were some overarching themes that seemed to be not necessarily universal truths, but at a very high level described each of the districts that we interviewed. First, what was really fascinating is there was an overarching theme of nutrition standards being changed as a part of a cultural shift, a move towards more healthy food. We heard a lot about schools modifying the entire food and beverage environment, trying to make the cafeterias more appealing to students so that they will stay and participate in the meal program. We heard things like this quote from a principal: to me, there's no such value in making the change. When he's talking about it, he's talking about financial value. It really was a no-brainer. It would be very selfish to think in terms of money. For me, it would have been. Other folks said things like, I don't know how to put a dollar value on it, that we did it because it was the right thing to do. This quote down on the bottom touches upon what I mentioned before, when she says things like, I don't think you can do one in isolation. It wasn't just a focus on competitive foods, but a much broader attempt to improve the food and beverage environment in schools and with a real focus on health and wellness. Something that we heard over and over again was that there was grumbling, and that is to be expected, right, with any policy change. Not everybody is going to be happy all the time. We also heard that initially there were declines in revenue. Some people weren't happy, but those issues subsided, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in just a few minutes. one of the initial barriers, I actually think this quote at the bottom, in fact, I can tell you this quote on the bottom comes from Boston. Their standards, and by the way, we told them that these would not be anonymous. in the case studies, there's names and phone numbers of folks that you can call and ask questions if you want. And that's kind of the point of the study, is to help put people in touch with people who have made this happen so that we can replicate their success. But Boston talked about the fact that they limited fruit juices to 4 ounces or less, and really had a hard time finding vendors that could meet that standard. Another district talked about the importance of working with your vendors when implementing policies, or not implementing, when developing the policies, so that you can create a policy that a vendor will be able to work with and still continue to supply food. When asked about ongoing barriers to maintaining profits now that some time has passed, the most common response from principals was there are no ongoing barriers. So again, we heard a lot about difficulty in the beginning. Maybe some people were unhappy. There were challenges that they had to overcome. But across the board, these schools have shown that those barriers can be overcome. The principals also most frequently cited that students needed time to adjust, and that students wanted a broad range of choices available to them. The folks that were in the room yesterday talked a lot about how important choice is to both students and adults, and that played out in our case studies as well. And we heard from schools that it wasn't about necessarily taking things away. The success story comes with recognizing that it's about providing better choices, and that you need to pursue this, you know, with that kind of paradigm shift in mind. We're not talking about banning things. We're talking about making better choices available. The most common response from food service directors about the kind of ongoing barriers that they still struggle with, even after some time has passed, again, is finding products that meet the standards. And they really emphasize the need to work with your vendors and include them in this process. There were other ongoing barriers that were cited, but not nearly as often. Obviously, open campus versus closed campus is a big issue, and how you deal with the open campus situation can be a problem. One school indicated that they had recently shortened their lunch period, not really intending to impact the meal program or competitive foods, but I guess an unintended consequence of that was higher participation in school meals. Something that was interesting, shortened the period. Yes. The cost of healthier food, things like spoilage, were also issues that were discussed, but less frequently. And then how do we apply these stronger nutrition standards to things like fundraisers and classroom celebrations was an ongoing barrier that was cited by some food service directors. It's worth noting that districts that had a lower free and reduced price meal participation indicated that they had to employ stronger promotions and strategies for maintaining a la carte and school meal items, or the sale of those items. I think one of the most fascinating things about this entire process was that we interviewed different kinds of stakeholders, and this was qualitative data, right, that we were collecting. We did not collect quantitative financial receipts. We did not do sales analysis using sales receipts. And in some ways, I think that's almost better, because perception can become reality even if it's not. And superintendents across the board couldn't provide any answers, did not provide any answers about sales data. And principals typically didn't know the answers to our questions about finances either. They continued to say, you need to talk to our food service director. When we asked simple questions like, I'm getting ahead of myself, but I'm going to jump to that slide since I'm talking about it. When we asked a really simple question about whether or not they maintained profit or lost profit, principals typically said that they did not know enough to answer, that if they were losing money, they weren't hearing about it. I think the implications of that is very, very large, right? If principals are losing money, they weren't hearing about it. In general, where there were losses, and food service directors did say that initially there were losses, they tended to be recovered by increased participation in school meals. And Michael mentioned earlier that they would suspect that improving nutrition standards for competitive foods would improve participation rates in the school meal program. our qualitative case studies showed that to be true. Again, here's another quote that really kind of just emphasizes the point that was on the previous slide, which is that focus on competitive foods and a la carte foods have kind of taken a back seat, this food service director says. We're not promoting competitive foods as much. It's not a focus. And we're not losing sleep. Nobody's saying, okay, let's work on competitive foods or what's the price. They're doing it because it's the right thing to do, and the culture shifted towards a culture of health and wellness. Again, I think I mentioned this before, but there was a broad range of strategies that were employed, from restructuring food service and food layout in cafeterias, coordinating with farm-to-school programs, student engagement and student feedback, student taste testing, and getting student buy-in through student taste testing and letting them have a say in the new kinds of foods that would be offered, education and modeling healthy eating habits to students, again, trying to have these nutrition standards be about something larger than just competitive foods and in a broader discussion about non-food rewards and fundraiser programs. As a component to this study, there are two short literature reviews that were also done, one regarding competitive foods in high school and middle schools, and then one in early childhood settings. The literature review suggests that diverse wellness committees with a broad range of stakeholders are key to development and implementation of strong nutrition standards, and that certainly was proven to be the case here. These schools tended to have very diverse wellness committees. Another key lesson learned is that principals cited buy-in, not profit or financial concerns, as their number one concern about changing nutrition standards in competitive foods. Financial issues was only the second most frequent concern. Again, jumping back to wellness committees, there was broad stakeholder engagement in these schools. They did taste testings and other strategies to build a groundswell of support from the bottom up. But they also tended to have strong champions that were working from the top down. This food service director, who's quoted at the bottom, really emphasized the need to find a champion and have somebody in the building that's there where the rubber hits the road, so that you have folks in the building making sure that the policies are implemented once they're adopted. We talked about the fact that now there's going to be this new rule coming down from the federal government, but there's also opportunities for change at a state level and a local level. One of the most common responses from principals and food service directors about what motivated the changes in nutrition standards in these schools was a change in a state law or regulation, which really underscores the fact that there are different levels on which we can do advocacy. If you're hitting a brick wall at the local level, it might be time to look for some sort of policy change at the state level. Again, the literature review that complements this project suggests that there will be an initial decline in revenue or profit, but sales will rebound, and that certainly played out in these case studies. Food service directors consistently indicated that they might have taken a financial hit in the beginning, but things improved over time and continue to rebound. So closing up, as I mentioned before, even though principals said that they don't know enough to tell us about financial data, they could consistently say if they're not losing money, or if they're losing money, they're not hearing about it, which is not the kind of environment where that's not illustrative of an environment that's having a significant political backlash. Not a single school district reported a significant political backlash, and not a single district that started implementing these changes reversed course or mentioned any plans to go back. So, as I mentioned before, we are wrapping up the final report. We're copy editing, and then I'll go off to graphic design. If you want a copy of the report to see these eight different case studies and the eight different stories, give me your business card, and I will be happy to send each and every one of you a copy.